It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. If your significant other craves pretzels and you go for tortilla chips, you may be heading for trouble. Sounds like funk, right? Well, evidently, it's real science. According to our guest today, neurologist Dr. Alan Hirsch, our choice of snack foods does reveal our personalities. He's neurologic director of the Smell and Taste Treatment and Research Foundation in Chicago. Jane and Michael Stern are noshing in the Napa Valley. Down the road at the French Laundry restaurant, we meet renowned chef Thomas Keller. Cheese maven Steve Jenkins wants us to take a cheese vacation. And master of wine Mary Ewing Mulligan talks the wines of Chile. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. I was thinking the other day about how at this time of year you don't need to do much to foods. So many things taste great raw or barely cooked. If you use too much heat or too many ingredients, you hide the incredible goodness of things like prime tomatoes or melons or nectarine or corn. But there are flavoring tricks, ways to accent what is already good, and some ways to liven up and brighten the tastes of things that just might be a little dull. So here's a few flavoring tips to use for fresh summer produce. Now, the first thing to remember is opposites do attract, and they can make that opposite flavor taste even better, especially when you're talking about sweet and tart. For example, when you get some really good corn on the cob, try this. Set off its sweetness with a blend of lime juice, chili, and salt. Now, you don't need much, but that tart, hot, and salty blend makes the corn taste sweeter and lusher. Salt is key with anything sweet. It makes it taste better, and it seems to heighten sweet flavors. So try salt and maybe a dash of lemon or lime on fruits that are in their prime. Just like with the corn. Now, don't overdo it. Just a little. But this combination will perk up peaches and melons and plums, most of the fruit family. Another thing to remember about really delicious fruit is that heat mutes its flavor. So, if you're going to cook a good peach, for instance, caramelize it fast and ruthlessly. Now, that browning brings a whole new kind of flavor to the party. And it's pretty good topped with a little vanilla ice cream, kind of like a summer sundae. So, how do you do ruthless caramelizing? You need fruit to be close to the heat, like a broiler or the bottom of a hot sauté pan. Also, you should know that fat and sugar accelerate caramelization. Now, this means that the fruit keeps most of its raw goodness while the part nearest the heat gets a delicious crusty brown glaze. So here's the details. Melt a little butter with two key ingredients. You add a drop or two of almond extract because it brings out good things in stone fruits like peaches and nectarines. Also, add a pinch of salt because that heightens the sweetness. Cut your fruit in half, brush it with the butter, and sprinkle it with just a haze of sugar. Have it up close to the broiler or cut side down in a hot sauté pan until it browns. Then serve that fruit topped with ice cream or just streak it with some cool heavy cream. While we're talking about fruits, I just learned something from John Rowley. He hunts down exceptional fruit for a chain of markets in the Northwest. He said nectarines and peaches are at their peak of sweetness when the yellow part of the skin turns a real rich gold. Now, I found that even nectarines that you've left out in a basket, you know how you leave them out too long and they start to wrinkle a little? Well, at that point, if they were good to begin with, they can taste absolutely wonderful, kind of like a lush, sweet, concentrated wine. There's another whole realm of summer eating that we all like, the raw tomato dishes, the salsas, the uncooked pasta sauces, the tomato salads, and almost always you team the raw tomatoes with raw onion and garlic. Well, sometimes that raw onion and garlic can be so strong it kills the dish. To tame the onion family down, you need a little acid. Sprinkle them with vinegar or citrus juice and just let them sit for 20 minutes. You'll end up with all the flavor, but none of that brash, overwhelming heat. Now, the other trick with raw onions, if you want to keep them crisp, is bury them in ice water for about 20 minutes. They'll get nice and mild. So, play opposite flavors against each other, tame down your onions and garlic, and join us again for the next edition of Kitchen Chronicles. Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by the home area at Target, where you'll find professional-style barbecue tools that feature genuine rosewood handles and stainless steel tangs. Target has the selection of barbecue tools you'll need for the grilling season. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions, and it's distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Our guest today may raise a few eyebrows. He is Dr. Alan Hirsch. He's an MD, a neurologist, who researches taste and smell. He claims that there are real physiological reasons why our food preferences reveal our personalities, like his snack food research. For instance, humanitarians eat tortilla chips, while the clean crazies love those cheese curls. Of course, I want to know, what do they do about the orange fingertips? Cheese authority Steve Jenkins has come up with some new travel adventures. How about a vacation centered on discovering great cheeses? Speaking of traveling, we're taking you to California, into the kitchen of a restaurant that many consider the best in the country. We visit the French Laundry and Chef Thomas Keller, a man obsessed with perfection. Then we have bargains, wine bargains. Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan wants us to take another look at the wines from Chile. Evidently, the reds really shine. There's a lot of good drinking here for not a lot of money. And as always, in the second half of the show, we open the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So I want to get things rolling with my favorite road food duo, Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Two for the Road column for Gourmet Magazine. Rumor has it you two have been in the West.
We've been in California wine country. And of course, what we found in California wine country was fabulous breakfast at the diner.
Without wine in it.
Now, which wine country are you talking about here?
We're talking about Yountville, California. And when I say the diner, I'm talking about a place called the Diner. It's actually a former bus depot many decades ago. And this is an old friend of ours. We have known about the diner for about 25 years. Cassandra Mitchell, who opened it 25 years ago, is still the proprietor, still grows her own herbs in a backyard garden, and still makes one of the best breakfasts north of San Francisco.
It's a very Jane and Michael Stern kind of place. You know, they have fiesta ware plates and old water pitchers and cookie jars, but it's, you know, it's very comfortable. It's not too, you know, kitsch, and it's not too self-conscious. But what I love about the diner is it's real blue plate, blue-collar food, but yet they go the extra mile. They make their own homemade fudge sauce for the sundaes. The hash browns are served with, you know, wonderful Yukon Gold potatoes with the skin on. You know, it's just everything is, you know, pancakes, eggs and sausage, sourdough bread, French toast, but it's taken to sort of the best degree. And I think you can only find a breakfast like that in California, where I think the breakfast consciousness is probably the highest of anywhere in the country.
I have to tell you, though, Lynn, we really always are faced with a terrible dilemma when we sit down for breakfast there, and that is whether we want to go with the kind of more sweet sort of pancakes or the savory pancakes, because the potato pancakes at the diner are some of the best I've ever had. They're real crisp and crusty and kind of thin and fine. And, you know, if you get that, obviously you're not going to be pouring syrup on them. On the other hand, the banana nut pancakes, which are sort of on the sweet end of things, you want them with maple syrup. So it's really a big dilemma about which way to go.
And it is real maple syrup. I think actually what I do is that the diner's always had sort of a Mexican flair to it. In fact, there were some nights that Cassandra Mitchell, the proprietor, would call it El Diner, and they would only serve Mexican food. You still can get this incredibly wonderful breakfast burrito, which is a huge whole wheat tortilla filled with zesty chorizo sausage and scrambled eggs and homemade salsa.
This is the Napa Valley, isn't it?
Yes, indeed it is. And you can have a mimosa with your breakfast if you want to.
Oh, that sounds too fancy. I mean,
I agree.
With a breakfast burrito?
Yeah, we have a cup of Java, but you know.
No, and in fact, they make great homemade malted milks there.
That's
so
true.
That's,
for breakfast?
Why not?
Oh, that I could do for breakfast.
Yes. You wouldn't think, because of the smells of, you know, bacon frying and bread baking when you walk in here, that, but one of the reasons people come to the diner is they're known far and wide throughout California, if not the rest of America, for their fountain specialties. They have hot fudge sundaes with homemade whipped cream, great malted milks, real hot chocolate, you know, just things that lemon and limeade, things that you used to take for granted in the 1950s, but now are a little labor-intensive to make and people don't do it anymore. Here you can get a classic California-style hot hamburger with just a great chocolate malt on the side.
Is this a big place? Like, how many people do they see?
It's kind of a cozy place. There's a counter and some booths. It's a classic diner shape, although it isn't one of the silver streamliners. I would say maybe 30, 40 people could be in there at one time. So it's just big enough to be comfortable and cozy at the same time.
And it's a very popular place. I really would suggest if you want to come for dinner, come on the early side, because the last time we were there, I mean, there were people just waiting on the front porch, you know. It's not a place that takes reservations, and it's the kind of place that only the locals really know about in wine country.
Hey, you two, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander through the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the
Michael Stern are the authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA. You can hear them here every week, and every week you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. Master of Wine Mary Ewing Mulligan is a Splendid Table regular. She's the co-author of the Wine for Dummies series of books. Mary, hi. Good to have you back.
It's great to be here, Lynn.
Mary, I'm seeing Chilean wines everywhere these days. I mean, every wine shop seems to have more and more of them, but I really don't know very much about them. Can you help me out?
Well, you know, I'm not surprised that you're seeing them, because actually these days, Chile is the number three foreign supplier of wines to the U.S. market after France and Italy. And of course, we've been seeing French and Italian wines on this market forever. The rapid success and rapid growth of Chilean wines is very impressive. Basically, I think that the reason that we're seeing so many of them is that Chilean wines have sort of entered a new phase in the 1990s, sort of their phase three of development. The first phase, well, Chile has a very long history. Winemaking began there in the 1500s. And then in the 1850s, vinifera, which is the classic wine grape species, was introduced to Chile from Bordeaux in the 1850s. And gradually becoming entrenched and replacing any other types of grape varieties over the past 150 years. And then in the 1990s, I would say phase three started, which was foreign investment in Chilean winemaking. And it just sort of completed the whole picture. And Chile is in a wonderful position to make terrific wines right now.
Do they make reds or whites?
Well, they make both. Personally, I prefer the reds over the whites. I've had some, over the years, some disappointments with Chilean white wines, but rarely a disappointment with the reds.
So what kind of reds are we talking about here?
Well, you see from Chile, you see the same grape varieties that you see from everywhere, you know, I mean, all the famous grape varieties that we know so well, such as Merlot, Cabernet Sauvignon. Among red grape varieties, those are the main two, sometimes Cabernet Franc. And for whites, you see Chardonnay and Sauvignon Blanc. Those are the two main grape varieties. I prefer the reds just because the learning curve in making a red wine tends to be a little bit shorter. And so they've got it down now, and they're making some excellent red wines. White wines have a slower learning curve. Things have been changing a lot with discovery of new vineyard areas that seem to be cool enough to make very good Chardonnays and Sauvignon Blancs.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I'd wait, you know, another vintage or two before I really started exploring the white wines of Chile, and I'd mainly look at the reds right now.
So which reds do you like?
Well, there are so many wineries in Chile these days, and every month, it seems, a new one comes onto the market here. Three that I've been very happy with over the years. One is Concha y Toro, and that is a major winery in Chile, shipping wines here under many different labels. Walnut Crest is one of the very inexpensive labels of Concha y Toro, and
mm-hmm.
then there's another one called Casillero del Diablo and other such labels. But it's a very, very reliable winery, well-grounded in the traditions of Chile. Another one that I like, it's a newer winery, is Montes, and a very simple name. Their best wine is called M. It's a super premium Chilean wine, which is a whole new sector, because Chilean wines generally are popular in the less expensive price categories. But I like Montes very much at all price levels. And another excellent winery is Casa La Postol. This is an example of foreign investment in Chile. It's a French company, a French family that has come to Chile and opened up a winemaking operation. So the grapes are Chilean and the expertise is French, and the wines are terrific.
Now, do these red wines attempt, you know, the winemakers trying to make these wines taste like the wines of France?
No, I would say that Chilean wines are sort of stylistically halfway between France and California. The intensity of fruit flavors tends to be stronger than what you find in most French wines. More like the fruit intensity that you find in a California wine. However, even at the inexpensive levels, the wines are totally dry and full of character. I find inexpensive California wines sometimes can tend to be a little on the soft side, maybe a little on the sweet side, or if not actually sweet, they give you that soft impression in the mouth as if they were sweet. And I find Chilean wines to be a little more traditional structurally, a little bit more like European wines in terms of their structure, but the intensity of flavor is more like a California wine.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say to our listeners that Chilean wines are great values. You can find plenty of Chilean wines for $5 a bottle, and generally they occupy the $5 to $10 price category, and certainly none of us mind finding good wines at that price level.
Sounds like a really good deal. Mary, thank you.
You're welcome.
Mary Ewing Mulligan is co-author with her husband, Ed McCarthy, of the Wine for Dummies series of books. You can get her Chilean wine picks on our website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, what your preference for Cheetos says about your personality. A study in perfection with Chef Thomas Keller and the French Laundry Restaurant. And your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Dr. Alan Hirsch researches taste. He's the neurologic director of the Smell and Taste Treatment and Research Foundation in Chicago. They treat people who have problems tasting and smelling. Dr. Hirsch looks at our taste preferences, what they reveal about us as individuals and as a species. Evidently, the human species' tastes are changing. Some of his findings might raise eyebrows. For instance, how much of our character is unveiled by a favorite snack food? Well, move over, horoscopes. According to Dr. Hirsch, if you crave tortilla chips, you're a humanitarian. Cheese curl aficionados maintain high moral standards and clean floors. And you potato chip lovers, well, you tend to be hotheads in traffic. Dr. Hirsch, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
I want to talk about the snack food studies that you've done, but first, I'd like to get an overview of your work. Has the way that we as a species experience taste changed?
Well, yes. You know, if you think about it, taste is a sense that's really very important for survival, because if you take in food that's poisonous, you won't survive. And oftentimes, bitter is associated with mean poisonous.
Uh-huh.
So we've learned to avoid bitter. But what's happened is over, especially over the last 100 years, we've been exposed to more and more levels of salt and sugar. So what happens is our ability to detect salt keeps getting worse and worse because we're taking more and more of it in.
Uh-huh.
On the other hand, our ability to taste bitter has remained preserved. So, for instance, the same substance, if we tasted 100 years ago in the United States, would taste very salty. Just today, would taste very bland.
Huh. Well, now, speaking of salt, you've done a study on snack foods. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, we have. Here in the world of psychiatry, we're continually looking for ways of understanding an individual's personality. And if you think about it, our underlying personality is the basis for why we make different decisions, why we decide to buy one type of car or another, or wear one tie as opposed to another type of tie. And we began to look at the idea of using food preferences as a way of determining personality type. It's sort of like a Rorschach test. You know, you look at this picture and it looks like a butterfly or a bat, and depending upon how you interpret it, you're able then to gain insight into one's personality type. Well, we did the same thing with snack foods, and what we did is we looked at 800 people, and we gave them all sorts of different personality tests, the MMPI, the MCMI, the Back of the Zong, and we were able to determine their personality type. And then we looked at their hedonic preferences in terms of which was their favorite snack foods, and we were able to statistically correlate their snack food preference with their personality type. And Americans love snack foods. They eat about 22 pounds a year. So it's something that Americans enjoy. And the question is why you choose one type of snack food over another. Well, part of it has to do with your upbringing, and part of it has to do with the cost. But to a large degree, it has to do with your underlying personality.
Well, okay. Well, for an example, I love potato chips. So what does that say about me?
Well, those who like potato chips the most are ambitious, successful, high achievers. They enjoy the rewards and trimmings of their success. They feel pride and happiness in their spouses and children, and they're easily frustrated at life's inconveniences. For instance, they're furious if they're stuck in rush hour traffic or if they have to wait in line, whether it be at the DMV or Disney World. And if you enter into competition with a potato chip lover, expect to lose because they're really very prepared adversaries.
I think I'm going to switch to another. All right, what about cheese curls?
Well, if I had to use one word to describe somebody who likes cheese curls, it would be the word integrity. They are formal, proper, conscientious, principled, and they maintain the moral high ground. They have a fine sense of right or wrong, and will justly treat those who are around them, whether they be the CEO or the busboy. And rather than showing a reckless disregard for the future, they plan ahead and anticipate any possible catastrophes. And if you're in somebody's house and it's so spotless you can eat off their floor, you're in a home of somebody who loves cheese curl.
This is amazing.
And what's so unique that we found is that people tend to be very specific to the food type. So, for instance, potato chip lovers will choose a barbecue potato chip as opposed to just switching to tortilla chips, so that they tend to be very food specific, and they remain that through their life.
But if we go to another country, do you think these same things would apply, for instance, or if we go to the third world?
No. As a matter of fact, we don't even know if they actually apply beyond the Midwest. We did this study in 800 people in Chicago and the suburbs, and it's distinctly possible that different areas of the country may have different responses. For instance, in New Orleans, there might be one aspect, or even in the Southwest, tortilla chips might be eaten by other personality types. We're just looking at that right now. And even beyond that, We've gotten some interesting phone calls. Employers are starting to use this now in helping to choose potential employees. And we even got a phone call from an attorney in California that wanted to use this as part of his voir dire of a jury, to choose a jury selection to help decide who would be most sympathetic towards his client.
That's really sneaky. But you've also done a study on weight loss and scent. Now, this one we've got to hear about. What were your discoveries there?
Well, you know, here at the Smell and Taste Treatment Research Foundation, we take care of people who've lost their sense of smell. And we found that after people lost their sense of smell, they often from a head trauma from an auto accident, they initially would gain 10 or 20 pounds. So we figured, gee, if when they lose their sense of smell, they gain weight, maybe if we gave them extra smell, they would lose weight. So we did a study of 3,193 people over 6 months. And we had them inhale different odors like banana and green apple and peppermint. And what we found is that by inhaling these odors whenever they felt like eating, there was an average weight loss of 2.1% body mass, or about 5 pounds a month in the study group. So an average of about 30 pounds over the course of 6 months.
All right. You're saying banana, green apple, and peppermint.
That's right. You know, it's sort of opposite what you expect. Originally, I thought if you give somebody an unpleasant odor, they'd get sick to their stomach. They wouldn't want to eat.
Right.
But we find actually that just the opposite. When you give them an unpleasant odor, they gained weight because they'd sniff it and they'd say, oh, this is horrible. They'd throw it in their purse and they wouldn't use it again. We actually found that the more they liked the smell, the more weight they lost. Because the more they liked it, the more they used it. And people would inhale anywhere from 18 to 288 sniffs a day, which is almost like one sniff every 3 minutes while they're awake. So maybe they're too busy sniffing to eat. But what we ended up finding is that if they liked the smell, it caused them to lose weight.
Doctor, thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure, and have a potato chip day.
Potato chip, how about just this potato chip? How about just this? Crunch, crunch, I don't want no lunch. All I want is potato chips.
Dr. Alan Hirsch is neurological director of the Smell and Taste Treatment and Research Foundation in Chicago, and is author of Dr. Hirsch's Guide to Scent-Sational Weight Loss. That's scent-sational, as in smell. For more information on his chip and personality profiles and his book, cruise by our website at splendidtable.org. This restaurant in California, in the Napa Valley, that has achieved official shrine status. We've lost count of its awards. It's impossible to get a reservation in the same calendar year, and customers practically genuflect and cross themselves when they finally do get inside the dining room door. The place is the French Laundry, and it's the creation of Chef Thomas Keller. His name is usually preceded by adjectives like genius and perfectionist. So, who is this man? Reporter Scott Haas went behind the scenes.
So, I'm here to find out, well, not so much the price of perfection, but, well, is it fair to say, I mean, the reputation that you have is as someone who strives for perfection in his food and in his restaurants. Is that an accurate description, do you think?
Well, as much as it can be, I certainly strive for perfection, and in itself it's something that we never reach. Once you reach perfection, I think it's all over.
How about the way in which ingredients are treated? I mean, I heard a rumor that the fish all face one way and all this kind of stuff. I mean, these rumors come up because of you're so much in the public eye in terms of the culinary world, and so these stories emerge about Thomas Keller. I mean,
well, it's all about respect for what we do, and you know, it's respect for the food, it's respect for life itself, and you know, the philosophy about the storing fish. I mean, fish should be stored the way it swims. If it's a flat fish, it's stored flat. If it's a round fish, it's stored straight up. And that's for a lot of different reasons, not only for respect, but for the more logical reasons. If you're going to store it on its side, it's going to get stressed out. You know, you're right. Our fish is iced down, or you know, it's got some pressure on it from the ice. So if you got one fillet on bottom of the other, there's that stress factor, and you're actually damaging it.
So there's a reason for these things.
There's a reason for these things. It's not all anal.
Well, I wasn't suggesting that. Hey, I didn't use the word. I mean, I'm here because I respect your work. You know, I wouldn't do that. What are you doing here?
I'm just portioning out this striped bass. So one of the things you noticed me doing, I was doing some scraping motions there. It's kind of like, what you know, the philosophy behind that is to dry the skin out as much as you can, because we want to cook that skin to where it's crispy. But at the same time, we don't want to overcook the fish. So we need to extract as much moisture from that skin as possible. So that skin will get really crispy really quick, which enables me to have more control over the degree of doneness that the fish comes. The way it glistens, the different colors in the meat, it's incredibly fresh. We have some very good suppliers.
You've worked on that, I guess, over a period of time?
All my life. All my career, I should say. It's an ongoing. We're always looking for better suppliers. We're always trying to get the suppliers we have to increase the quality of their products. Although some of them are quite perfect.
I can't help noticing. Is he cutting up the big slabs of foie gras over there?
He does. Gregory's cutting the foie now for his service tonight.
That's gorgeous.
Yeah. And you see how thick he's cutting. It's very important to cut thick. Most people are afraid to cut it that thick because of the expense. But if you don't have a thick piece, you don't get the different textures that we created. A nice crispy exterior with a nice molten interior. If you don't have a crispy, if you don't have a thick piece of foie gras, you can never achieve those contrasts in textures and flavor. And that's what we need to do. That's the best thing about foie gras.
I know about the way in which you approach, I mean, I know a little bit about the way in which you approach, for lack of a better word, perfection in the dishes that arrive at the tables in the restaurant. But is there a way in which this kitchen is organized that's different than the way other restaurant kitchens are organized?
Well, I'm not sure how the restaurant kitchens are organized. We certainly have a hierarchy here, and we have systems, and we believe in systems. We try to create routines, because routines are very important. It's also a very unique situation, because the kitchen itself and the environment of the kitchen is very open. We have vaulted ceilings. There's skylights in the roof, in the ceiling. There's skylights in the ceiling. There's windows all along. We look out onto a magnificent garden. The Mayacamas Mountains are right there. You know, this is for a cook. You know, that's the kind of thing that you're usually stuck in the basement somewhere without any view.
Yeah, no windows at all.
Right, no
windows. Now, I suppose what I'm seeing here is typical of your kitchen. It's pretty noisy and busy, and everyone seems to be doing stuff.
Yeah, I mean, if they're not doing
nobody's sitting around having a smoke. I mean.
Right, exactly. The kitchen's set up exactly as the menu is set up, and if you've never been here before, the menu is a prefix menu. We offer five different courses on one of the menus.
When I ate here before, I mean, it wasn't so much appetizers and entrees, it was a series of different tastings.
Right, exactly, and that's what I'm saying. My first course, canapé, first course, fish course, meat course, cheese course, dessert course. The portions are geared, they're a little smaller. They typically run around 3 to 4 ounces as opposed to 6 to 8 ounces, which in my philosophy, the more somebody has of something, the more they become tired of it.
Yes.
And the less impact that it has on them. Here, what we're doing is, since we offer multi-courses, we're satisfying your hunger over a longer period of time, which is actually a healthier way to eat. I've also left you with the impression that every dish that you had was incredible.
It's almost as if you sat at my table when I was here, because it was when you finished finished what you were eating, you said, well, I want more of that. But then the next thing came and we said, no, I want more of that.
Right. Well, that's what we want to leave you with. I want one more bite. That's certainly one of our philosophies.
You know, I was wondering, you know, given the standard that you set for yourself, the margin of error isn't that great. In other words, like, is every evening like, oh my God, we're going to crash and burn, or is every evening?
No, we don't think about crash and burning. Believe me, that never enters our head.
I wasn't suggesting that you worry about failure. What I meant was that, given the level of perfection or the standard that you set for yourself, do you feel you fall short of it?
Oh, always, always.
What time does service begin tonight?
5:30.
I don't want to take any more of your time. I want to thank you for inviting me in your kitchen and showing me around. And
there are 74 of us that work at the French Laundry in a 62-seat restaurant. And our one goal for everybody is to create wonderful memories for our guests, and we try to do that every day.
Well, thanks again.
Thanks, Doug.
74 employees to serve 62 guests. Quite a ratio. Scott Haas covers food and wine for WBUR and writes for Gourmet Magazine. The piece was produced for us by John Marston. We have a recipe for you from Thomas Keller's award-winning book, The French Laundry Cookbook. It's for sautéed cod with cod cakes and parsley oil. You can get it on our website at splendidtable.org. Steve Jenkins can't resist a great cheese. He's been hunting down handmade quality cheeses in Europe and America for over 25 years, and he drops by regularly to talk cheese. Steve, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn. Thanks for having me back.
Well, Steve, I want to know, where should I go for a cheese vacation? Where should I go for great cheeses?
Well, I think you should go to Southwest France. I think you ought to either fly into Madrid or fly into Paris, and then either jump in a car at either place, or from Madrid fly right on up to Bilbao,
mm-hmm.
or from Paris fly down to Bordeaux,
right.
and jump in a car, rent a car. Let's say you flew to Paris and then you went directly to Bordeaux.
Okay.
You get to drive down that gorgeous area called the Landes, which is really the heart of foie gras country. And if you'll drive along the beach, the beaches are like a mile wide, pure sand, nothing but suddenly the white sand stops and the ocean starts. And when you get back the other way, then it's just pine trees and camps, horse riding camps. And as you get farther down, I mean, all along the road, you see people selling foie gras. It's the damnedest thing you ever saw.
Okay.
Then you get like an hour and a half down the road in the Landes heading due south, and you're going to come to Biarritz, one of the great old cities in Europe, which used to be known for all the Brits that would spa there. But Biarritz is just this adorable little ocean beach town that's got this extraordinary hotel, the Hotel du Palais, that's just magnificent. Fabulous markets every place. And the cheese in this region is magnificent. It's my favorite cheese in the whole world. Plus, you've got Spain right there in the Basque Country with my other favorite cheeses in the whole world.
So you're right near the border.
Right on the border. The area around Biarritz is the Basque Country, and Southwest France is known for the sheep's cheeses. And every village has a magnificent, firm, oily, rich, buttery sheep's cheese they're so fine they stand alone. Right? You don't need to jazz them up with a whole lot of other things. It's the quintessential picnic cheese of all. And right on the other side of the border in Navarra, right next to the Basque Country, you've got the other great sheep's cheeses that are of Spanish origin, like Roncal and Idiazabal, which is a smoked sheep's cheese. It's just a fabulous area to visit. In every direction, 360 degrees, is gorgeous, gorgeous, either mountains or the beach. I mean, that's what's happening for me, anyway. Plus, you got Bilbao right around the corner. That's an easy drive. You can see the Frank Gehry Museum.
Okay, but can we bring these cheeses back with us, you know, bring them into the United States?
Yes, these are completely legal cheeses to bring home, sure.
So the deal here is go to the market, right,
mm-hmm.
and whatever you see that comes from a sheep, buy it and taste it?
Buy it, absolutely.
Okay.
They got great sheep's milk yogurt. There's tons of little goat's milk farm cheeses that are just terrific. There's a great cheese guy in Biarritz who's very well known. It's just a joy. I mean, if there's one place I would say I really want to take my wife Michelle and me It'd be right back to Biarritz, Saint-Jean-de-Luz, Pamplona, where they run the bulls right across the border. Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, a little bit inland with this gorgeous river tarn that runs through it. The most spectacular thing you've ever seen.
Okay, we've got a deal. We've got a cheese vacation. Hey, Steve, thank you.
Pleasure.
Steve Jenkins is the author of Steve Jenkins Cheese Primer. You can find information on his cheese vacation on our website at splendidtable.org. Okay, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. This week, it's a test of your champagne savvy. Check out champagne labels. You'll often see one of two terms, Blanc de Blanc or Blanc de Noir. So, what do they mean? We'll be back with that answer in a moment, and we're opening the lines for your calls, so get on those phones. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. We're opening the lines for your calls in a moment at 800-537-5252, but before getting to the phones, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. It tests how savvy you are about champagne. The question was, what do the terms Blanc de Blanc or Blanc de Noir on a champagne label mean? Well, Blanc de Blanc means a white wine made from white grapes. And Blanc de Noir means a white wine made from red grapes. Okay, so how do you make white wine from red grapes? Well, you press the grapes to get their juice, then you separate the skins from the juice, because it's the skins that give the wine its red color. So do they taste different? Well, they do. Of course, it's going to depend on the maker, but Blanc de Blanc champagne is almost always a Chardonnay, while the Blanc de Noir can be made from the red Pinot Noir grape or other grapes. The point is, red grapes give champagne the flavors of berries and a distinctive richness that you usually taste after you've swallowed the wine. Now, there's another sparkling wine out there. It's made mainly from white grapes, and it's not French. It's Italian, from just north of Venice. But I think this is one of the great wine buys around, and you can make a wonderful summer aperitif with it. The wine is Prosecco, and it sells for between $9 and $13 a bottle. Now, you drink it chilled on its own, or you make the classic aperitif from Venice. That's a Bellini, supposedly invented at Harry's Bar in the 1930s. It's a puree of white peaches added to a glass of sparkling golden Prosecco. Now, if you've ever met up with a great white peach, you know that this has got to be a winner. Really fine white peaches taste like a mix of honey, sweet spice, and your basic nectar of the gods. They're in season right this minute, so this weekend, make Bellinis. Here's how you do it. You get some ripe white peaches, puree them, then put a tablespoon or two of puree in the bottom of each glass and add the chilled Prosecco. That's it. It is time to open the lines for your calls. Phone us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Anything goes. Let's get right to it. We have Mark on the line. Mark, what's up?
Hi, Lynn. I just got back from China a couple weeks ago, and before I went, everybody kept telling me, well, they don't have regular Chinese food over there in China. So.
No chow mein, no chop suey. I mean, why are you going?
Well, I had an opportunity to go to a place called Fuzhou, which I understand, you know, China's so vast. There's many different foods, I'm sure, throughout all of China. Uh-huh. But Fuzhou is a city on the coast of a couple million between Shanghai and Hong Kong, right across from Taiwan there.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, of course, they had a lot of seafood there, sea slugs and all kinds of crazy, unrecognizable sea creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the more interesting things they had was they had all this live food out there, live and fresh, you know, raw
mm-hmm,
food. And,
mm-hmm.
and it was a buffet thing they had set up at one time. And one of the guys is grabbing these crawdads and trying to put them on his plate, and they kept running off of his plate. And,
I'm sorry.
And I'm wondering, how are we eating
I
this?
I can hear the vegetarians in the audience right now. They've turned off their radio. Well, they're gone. Okay.
So, but what they had was then a hot boiling broth pot on the actual table there. So you would take these live and raw things there and just toss them in the pot, and they would cook, and then you would eat them. And at first I thought I was eating sushi, and then they explained that, no, you're supposed to cook it first.
You know, use a fly swatter as the first step toward having dinner. I remember Ken Holm, you know, the Chinese food authority, who saying something about food in China and the standard for freshness. And the standard for freshness is evidently that it is alive. And it is then, it meets its demise just before you take it home to cook it. And the
right.
fact is, this it, in a climate where refrigeration is tricky, or in a culture where people set a very high standard on the quality of what they eat, doesn't it make sense?
Yeah, it does.
How did you like the taste? I mean, what did these things taste like? Did you enjoy the meal?
Well, yeah, I mean, those sorts of things, I really enjoy the seafood and everything, but I tried everything, and they don't let anything go to waste. You know, in fact, most of the things were various animal parts that, you know, innards of pigs and feet and chicken feet and you name it. So I tried everything, not everything I liked, but, you know, you have to be polite, and we were at a lot of different banquets and things like that. So I did enjoy the pigeon. I had pigeon.
Uh-huh.
And the favorite thing, even though I didn't know what it was, I kept trying this brown tofu everywhere. They'd have, when I got off the plane, they gave me this wonderful soup that had this brown tofu in it. And it wasn't until later I found out it was blood.
That brown tofu.
Right, curdled.
That,
yeah.
Well, you know, it was an ingredient years, centuries ago, a long time ago in France. Why not? But did you
high
have
in protein.
Yes, exactly. Did you have any scorpion by any chance?
No, we didn't. We didn't try that. I didn't see any around, but we were on the coast.
We had heard about scorpion restaurants in China from one of our guests. What is the overall? Were you there, by the way, as sort of a visiting dignitary? I mean, it sounds like you were entertained at banquets and that kind of
right.
thing.
Right. We were part of a international dragon boat racing team from Tacoma, Washington, to our sister city of Fuzhou. So we were hosted there by the government, and you know, they were treated us just great. You know, they were just fantastic over there, and the people were great. We were like celebrities in this town. So
Mark, I would bet you had a chance to eat food that most of us who would just go over there as tourists wouldn't stand a chance of a snowball in hell of getting near. I mean, you were really lucky.
Yeah, I'm fairly adventurous, you know, but I think I went out there pretty much to my limit, but it was a fantastic experience. We had one kid, actually a couple kids along with us, and I had to walk them through the buffet and say, look, these are actually drumettes, you know, and here's some fried rice, okay, you recognize that. And so we had a couple kids turn white when they saw what they were supposed to eat, but I had to actually point out that some of these things were what they actually ate at home.
Hey, exposure at a young age is a good thing. Mark, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
One man's sea slug is another man's porterhouse steak. Remember, everything is a matter of your point of view. Calford is on the line. So, Calford, what's happening?
Oh, well, what happened? I've been looking for an Iron Dutch butt for a long time. I'm from Jamaica, and
I never would have guessed.
My mother used to use a Dutch butt for all of her meats. She used to do her browning of beef inside of it.
Uh-huh.
And I've been using, you know, aluminum here, and I don't like it at all.
No. You want that cast iron pot. That's going to be great. Where have you been looking? Where haven't you found it? Let's start there.
I have been looking. You know, I live in New York City.
Oh, you should be able to find it in New York.
Probably I'm not looking at the right place.
Well, you know, the first thing, the place I would look, believe it or not, would be camping stores. You know, stores that sell equipment for camping. Because in the United States, a lot of people use pots like that for outdoor cooking.
Okay.
Now, did your mom use one that had feet on it?
She used both. She used a flat one, but she used one with feet.
This to me, because one of the things I love about the ones with feet is you can use those, well, you do use those, right over the embers of a fire.
Yes.
And I just think they're great, especially if you have a fireplace. If you don't have a fireplace,
right,
you know, find a fire.
Yeah.
And they're really great. The other place, by the way, it just occurred to me, the other place to look, hardware stores.
Okay.
Now, I know New York hardware stores maybe don't get as earthy as hardware stores in other parts of the country, but you may find them in some hardware stores.
Okay.
Okay?
Great.
All right. And then what we want you to do, once you have found that iron pot,
right,
and you have been cooking in it for a while, call us and tell us some of the way your mom used to use it.
Okay. I'll tell you about the turn cornmeal and stuff like that.
Ooh, yeah. Okay. Okay.
All right.
Hey, Calford, thank you.
I heard, just a comment, side comment. I heard you wonder about using bananas, and you mentioned only ripe bananas. You've never talked about boiling green bananas?
Tell me about boiling green bananas.
Oh, every Sunday and Sunday morning, we get up and boil that water, put a little bit of oil in it so the stain of the banana doesn't stick to the pot. And cut the banana, the green bananas, in half,
uh-huh,
and slit the sides so that it can be easily peeled. Just throw it in there and watch it so that it doesn't become too soft.
Uh-huh.
Because you want a little bit of...
So you've got the skin still on the banana, though.
Yes.
Ah, this is interesting. And then what do? You cook it until it's just tender?
Yes.
And then what?
Just, you can eat it with salt fish, that's cod.
Oh, gosh, that sounds
right?
good.
Or, you know, anything like that.
Do you put anything on top of it? I mean, like, do you put things like, you know, garlic or butter or anything?
In the cod, when you make the cod as a side dish,
yeah,
you know, you stir-fry it, sort of with a little bit of olive oil in there. And that's where you put the garlic, the onions, and the herbs, and so on.
And then you eat that with the banana.
Yes.
That sounds awfully good. And then the leftovers I could cut up and fry, right, at pan fry. Okay, okay. Hey, Calford, thank you.
Okay. Bye, then.
Goodbye. I'm starving. And this brings to mind the fact that this is peach and nectarine season. I mean, they're not going to get better than right now. And if you're frustrated because all you can get is kind of crummy supermarket peaches and nectarines, I have found a mail order source that is really great. It's an organic farm in California, and they ship peaches and nectarines. It's called Frog Hollow Farm. I've had two shipments from these people, and, you know, the juice is running down my arm. This stuff is really good. So it's Frog Hollow Farm. You can find them on the web, but we're going to put the information up on the website as well. That's splendidtable.org. Okay, let's get back to the phones. We've got Joel on the line. So, Joel, what's on your mind?
Well, I wonder if there's some way of telling the heat content of a pepper before you put it into a dish.
Well, knowing the kind of pepper it is.
No, I'm saying I know a jalapeno is less spicy than a serrano,
right,
and a habanero is the most. But I'm saying in jalapeno, sometimes the recipe will call for two or three. And I've put two into a recipe, and it turns out to be much too spicy. And mm-hmm. sometimes I put three in, and it's not spicy enough. So I'm just wondering, you know, whether or not there is some way of telling beforehand the spice level of a pepper.
You mean just by looking at it?
Or tasting it or doing something to find out.
Well, what you're experiencing are the variables that exist in the chili family. Mm-hmm. And the chili family, it's really a fascinating, fascinating thing, because depending on which botanist you talk to, there's somewhere between 300 and 1,500 different chilies out there in the world. Each one not only has a different heat level, but it tastes different. You know, it has a different, some are velvety and sweet, some are citrusy, some are flowery.
Right.
Some just taste like, you know, you're putting needles in your tongue. They're just so blessedly hot you can't eat them.
Absolutely.
And if you know the type of chili you're using, you know, there's books out there, and there's probably on the web, there's something called a Scoville scale, and that tells you how hot a chili is. For instance, I think on a Scoville scale, an habanero, you know, which is the one that can take the top of your head off, is 250,000 units,
right,
and something like a jalapeno is about 25,000 units.
Okay.
Even when you get a bunch of jalapenos, as you found out, they're all different. I have actually sat in a field of peppers in New Mexico, you know, a field of pepper plants,
sure,
chili plants, and had a farmer very carefully cut a chili off of the plant, and this was a chili that was quite hot, and he didn't jostle it in any way, and he cut between where the veins would be, and he took out a piece of the flesh, and he put it in my mouth, and it was like eating a sweet pepper.
Huh.
And the reason is that the stuff that makes chilies hot is this kind of oily substance that develops on the inside on the veins of the peppers. And when you jiggle it, it gets
right,
spread around. He also told me on the same plant, the chilies will vary in heat.
So I've got a problem.
You've got a problem, but I think the key here is forget about standardizing the cooking. You're going to have to trust your palate. So take a taste of the chili before you add it. And I'd say start out, you know, it's that old business, start out with a little bit, taste your way, keep adding more as you need it.
Okay.
That's the deal. But it's a very good question, and sadly, they're not all uniform. But thanks a lot.
Okay, Lynn, thank you.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, our time is gone. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Have a great week. And remember, you can call us anytime at 800-537-5252. Our answering machine just loves the attention. Let me leave you with a quote from food writer Carol Cutler. A pâté is nothing more than French meatloaf that's had a couple of cocktails. Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, the only place you can register for kitchen essentials. 1810 stainless steel cookware from Calphalon. It's professional quality heavy cookware with tempered glass lids and ergonomic handles. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. The associate producers are Jennifer Lutke and Jennifer Russell. Our theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.